This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're hearing from Pulitzer Prize winners today. Lawrence Wright spent nearly 5 years researching al-Qaeda, interviewing more than 600 people, including members of al-Qaeda and related jihadist groups, as well as friends and relatives of Osama bin Laden. The result, his book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, was widely lauded even before winning a Pulitzer yesterday. It won the Lionel Gelber Prize, the J. Anthony Lucas Book Prize, and was a finalist for the National Book Award. The Looming Tower explores the development of al-Qaeda, as well as the efforts of FBI agents to crack the organization before it carried out the September 11th attacks. Wright is currently performing My Trip to Al-Qaeda, a stage presentation based on the book. Wright is a staff writer for The New Yorker and has authored 6 previous books. He also co-wrote the screenplay for The Siege, a 1998 film starring Bruce Willis and Denzel Washington about the nation's reactions to a band of Islamic terrorists. Our guest host, Dave Davies, spoke with Lawrence Wright last year after The Looming Tower was published.
Well, Lawrence Wright, welcome to Fresh Air. Osama bin Laden is known to a lot of people as a man who really made his bones in Afghanistan in the 1980s, recruiting and leading Arabs in the fight against the Russian invasion there. Your book looks at that in some detail. How significant was bin Laden and his Arab recruits? How significant was their role in the war?
It was utterly insignificant. In fact, they were an obstacle to victory, if anything. The Afghans were mystified by these death-seeking Arabs who came seeking martyrdom to Afghanistan when the Afghan people really were seeking liberation. So they had completely different objectives. The Arabs, when they arrived, had no idea that the Soviets might actually be defeated. They were only looking to engage in jihad and find their way to paradise. So oftentimes they would rush into battle and complicate things immensely and get killed in great numbers as they did. But they really contributed nothing to the eventual outcome, which was the withdrawal of the Soviet forces.
However, their exploits were in fact sold in the Arab world as pretty remarkable, right?
Oh, bin Laden in particular was a wonderful spin master. And after the Soviets withdrew from Afghanistan in 1989, the entire Soviet Union fell apart. And so the mythology just grew that, you know, this band, this legend of this small band of men that rushed in to defend Islam and then slayed the mighty superpower so thoroughly that it completely disappeared. That grew up around bin Laden, and he did a lot to create that mythology himself.
Now, even though bin Laden and his fellow Arab fighters weren't effective as a military force and often left out and ignored by the real Afghan fighters, you write that bin Laden himself began to develop a vision of maintaining a core of Islamic fighters for future efforts. What exactly was he conceiving of then?
Originally, he was an anti-communist. His goal was to drive the Soviets out of Afghanistan and then on through Central Asia. And also, he was particularly attached to his ancestral homeland, Yemen, which had a communist government at that time. So his conception was that he was going to create a Muslim, specifically an Arab, foreign legion that could be on call to go wherever in the world Muslims were oppressed, especially by communists. And when the Soviet Union then proceeded to fall apart, there was bin Laden with a small army but no enemy.
Now, he makes his way back to Saudi Arabia after the Russians retreat in 1989. What is his status in the country then?
He was a really paradoxical figure in Saudi Arabia, which is a place where, you know, the royal family really hoards all the glory. You know, there are no photographs, no portraits of anyone other than the leading princes. All the hospital wings are named after them, the streets and so on. So if you're not royal, you may be rich, but you're really not anyone. You're just living, you're a guest in the House of Saud. And here came this young man who was rich, who was glamorous, who was ambitious, who had a small army at his disposal, and he became Saudi Arabia's first celebrity. which was a category they hadn't had to contend with before that.
Did he see himself then as a jihadist, or was he a guy who was going to raise his children and stay with his wives?
After bin Laden came back to Saudi Arabia in 1989, he settled down. He was investing in companies in Jeddah and Medina, and something happened though that disrupted that kind of peaceful idyll. In 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and the Iraqi army was poised on the Saudi border. And, of course, the kingdom was in a panic about what to do. And bin Laden went to the defense minister and proposed that he would use his organization, al-Qaeda, to defend the kingdom, along with several hundred thousand unemployed Saudi youth and the bulldozers and caterpillars that were at his disposal at the Saudi bin Laden company. The Iraqi army had 1 million men. It was one of the largest tank corps in the world. And the defense minister just laughed at him. And the king then invited the Americans to come save them from the Iraqi threat. Bin Laden was really offended by this, offended by his treatment, offended that the Saudis would turn to heretics and apostates as he saw the Americans and bring them onto the holy land of Saudi Arabia, where, as the prophet said on his deathbed, there should be no two religions in Arabia. He saw this as a huge offense against Islam.
So Osama bin Laden comes into conflict with the royal family of Saudi Arabia because he condemns them for their invitation of U.S. troops in. It eventually reaches the point where he has to leave and makes his way to Sudan. How did he come to resettle in the country of Sudan?
Well, Sudan had just gone through an Islamic revolution and led by this philosopher king named Hassan al-Turabi. And Turabi had sent emissaries to bin Laden to invite him to come to Khartoum because he knew that bin Laden was very rich and involved in the construction business, and he wanted someone like that to come invest in Sudan. At the time, the Sudanese government opened the country to anyone who said he was a Muslim. And consequently, a number of different terrorist groups who were unwanted in their own countries began streaming into Khartoum. And it became a haven for the PLO, the PFLP, Abu Nidal group. Every known terrorist group seemed to have a foothold, if not a headquarters, in Khartoum. And it was into this nest of very dissident factions that bin Laden arrived in 1992, bringing the kind of straggly band of al-Qaeda fighters from Afghanistan and other points to reassemble there and set up camps.
The retreat of the American forces from Somalia has been cited as another example in which Islamic fighters stood up to the United States and forced it to retreat. You said earlier that Osama bin Laden had done a great job of spinning his role in Afghanistan. Did he exaggerate his role in Somalia as well? How did he describe his role and the role of his compatriots in Somalia?
Well, he often takes credit for things that he doesn't really deserve, and then sometimes he denies having done things. But in Somalia, they seem to have had very little to do with the actual fighting. They probably did have something to do with some of the training of the Somali tribesmen. But bin Laden took credit for having shot down, or at least having sponsored that, and shot down the Black Hawk helicopters. And the lesson he drew from that was that just a small strike against the Americans will send them running. They were not a frightening foe. All they had to do was kill a few servicemen, and then they drag their tail out of there as quickly as they can.
Well, in the late 90s, Osama bin Laden is compelled to leave Sudan. And he's then a man without a country. It's remarkable to read. We think of him as a rich and powerful guy, but he ends up making his way to Afghanistan, and he's essentially broke and powerless, right?
That's right. The Saudis had cut off his allowance from the Saudi bin Laden group, his father's company, which was essentially the only way he made any money. When he went to Sudan, he was worth about $7 million. That's about how much his portion of that company was worth. And he had an annual allowance that sometimes amounted to as much as $500,000. That was a substantial amount of money in Sudan. And so at that time, you know, the legend of him being a billionaire had spread around. He was not anywhere near that. But when he left Sudan, all of his investments were essentially stolen by the Sudanese government. He was almost penniless. He may have had, one Sudanese intelligence officer told me that he might have had about $50,000. But bin Laden's business manager, a man named Abarida al-Suri, said he was penniless. So when he got to Afghanistan, he had to throw himself on the mercy of some of the old warlords that he used to fight with.
So he's in Afghanistan with his followers, with his family, and he's broke. He's cut off from the wealth that his family's construction business had generated in Saudi Arabia. What turns around his fortune? Where does he get the money to once again become a threat and a force?
First of all, he made an alliance with the Taliban. When the Taliban were besieging Kabul and bin Laden had arrived, he thought that they were probably communist. He had no idea who the Taliban really were. But the Taliban took care of him for a while. You know, he had old alliances in the Saudi kingdom and friends who would bring him some money. And he didn't need much. This is one of the things about al-Qaeda that's so striking, is how cheaply they are able to operate. He sent several operatives down to Africa to start a cell in Kenya and one in Tanzania. And they had to earn their own living. They went into the fishing business, for instance, and very, very marginal. But when he was able to bomb the two American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in August of 1998, that was, you know, a very dramatic event. But our response to that event, to send 56 cruise missiles over that did a lot of harm but no damage to al-Qaeda, that elevated him in the eyes of many disaffected Muslims in the world, and it completely restored his fortunes with them.
Give us a sense of what kind of leader Osama bin Laden was. I mean, he does not, from your account, to appear to be a riveting orator, and yet he somehow did inspire people. How was he effective as a leader?
Well, certainly in the beginning, he was not an effective leader. He was under the spell of Abdullah Azzam, a very charismatic, commanding figure. But bin Laden always had this dream of creating this Arab Legion. And there was another man that saw in bin Laden the possibilities for real leadership. And this man was Ayman al-Zawahiri, the Egyptian, who had spent 3 years in Egyptian prisons and had emerged a hardened propagandist. He saw bin Laden and knew what to do with him, a little like maybe Colonel Parker saw Elvis. You know, I mean, he saw the possibility here. He saw that this young man at that time had a lot of money. He was a Saudi, which has great standing in the Muslim world because they're seen as being the most holy of people. And he was rich, and here he was living in these deprived circumstances fighting jihad. All of those things had not occurred to bin Laden that they could become iconic, but Zawahiri immediately recognized their utility and he put them to use. So when bin Laden began to talk about creating al-Qaeda, Zawahiri surrounded him with his own Egyptian leaders, people that were military men, policemen, technocrats, engineers, the kind of people that could really put together that operation. And by that, he really captured bin Laden and his dream and steered it into the organization that it is now. I would have to say I'm not intending to slight bin Laden and his leadership, because if it weren't for bin Laden, we wouldn't have the al-Qaeda we have now. Most of these groups, these jihadi groups, are nationalistic in focus. It was bin Laden that decided to make this kind of international umbrella and put them all under one tent and direct them mainly towards America.
When he first came to Afghanistan, conditions were very sparse. After the successful bombings in Kenya and Tanzania, money and recruits came in at a much larger scale, and you describe an al-Qaeda which was quite a large going concern, and some of the procedures they had, they actually had, what, salaries? They had policies?
Right. Paid vacations, a month-long vacation, and health care benefits, and you get a round-trip ticket home each year. It was all very bureaucratic. One of the things that bin Laden brought to the world of terror is a lot of managerial expertise and a kind of bureaucratic overlay. You'd have to fill out forms in triplicate in order to buy new tires, for instance. But all of this imposed a certain discipline that hadn't been present in that kind of organization before.
During this time, bin Laden and this organization is responsible for incredible savagery. There were the attacks, the bombings of the embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, and the attack on the USS Cole in Yemen. Where did the idea for the 9/11 attack come from?
Well, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was, first of all, not a member of al-Qaeda at the time. He came to visit bin Laden in 1996. His nephew, Ramzi Youssef, had been the mastermind of the World Trade Center bombing in 1993, which killed six people and really actually sent more people to the hospital. It was a terrible incident. It doesn't seem so big in retrospect, but there were more people hospitalized by that than any other civil action since the Civil War. So it was a very bad bombing, and he became kind of legendary in these underground jihadi circles. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, his uncle, had fled the Philippines after the Philippine police had caught on to their plotting to destroy these airliners over the Pacific. And so he found his way to Afghanistan to try to sell his vision of this airline plot. Very similar to the recent one in Britain, where they were going to get on 12 American airliners, mix some chemicals together on board, and blow them up over the Pacific. So this is the scenario that he was trying to peddle to bin Laden. And bin Laden at the time thought it was too complicated, and yet he wanted Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to join al-Qaeda. And he wouldn't do that at that time, but a few years passed, and he did come back in and begin working with bin Laden. They refined the plot over a couple of years. It started out with, we're going to hijack these airliners in the Pacific. But then bin Laden started thinking about another alternative, which was to train these men to actually be the pilots and to use the aircraft as weapons, not just as bombs.
As the 9/11 attack approaches, you describe bin Laden in Afghanistan gathering his followers and retreating to a kind of a mountain hideout. I guess this was Tora Bora, right? And bringing a satellite receiver and a TV set because he knows the attack is coming. Most of those around him do not. And you write that that he and a number of al-Qaeda members are beset by vivid dreams involving airplanes.
Yes, these premonitory dreams were just rife. People were imagining dreams of pilots playing soccer, for instance, and actual dreams of airplanes hitting buildings. And there was a culture in al-Qaeda where people would come to tell bin Laden or one of the other leaders about their dreams, and they would just sit around and discuss them and what kind of premonitory events these might presage. And bin Laden finally told them, no more dreams about airplanes. He didn't want the plot to be given away in this supernatural fashion.
Well, Lawrence Wright, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Lawrence Wright spoke with Dave Davies last year after the publication of Wright's book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. Yesterday, the book won a Pulitzer Prize for general nonfiction. The Pulitzer for music went to Ornette Coleman for his CD Sound Grammar.